Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Listener, this is the 89th episode of Haaretz Weekly, and in all that time, we've never had to use the profanity bleeper once. I have a feeling, though, that might change today. Not because of my guest, God forbid. She is the very essence of decorous language. No, it's the subject matter that might entail the use of a few choice expletives. From Seth Rogen's controversial take on American Jewry's relationship with Israel to the very real protests taking place here in Israel, there's always likely to be a swear word on our lips today. So if producer Aaron is ready with the bleep machine, let's hear a jingle and dial up Alison Kaplan Summer. Hi, Alison. It's been ages.
Hey, how you doing, Simon?
I'm good. How the heck are you?
You know, that's a really loaded question these days. I don't quite know how to answer it.
Well, I have an answer prepared, and I've been waiting for an opportunity to use it.
So let me ask. Simon, how are you?
Thank you. Well, I'm pulling a reverse Timothy Leary. I'm locked down, fed up, and pissed off. But apart from that, everything is good. Everything is good. Alison, the most commented article on Haaretz.com last week was your report on Seth Rogen's in-depth conversation with Mark Maron on the WTF podcast. What did he say that's got our readers so riled up?
Well, before I get to the riled up, his name is pronounced Maron, but I think most Israelis these days would pronounce it Moron, so it's very appropriate that you said Maron. Seth Rogen sort of was the classic, I would say, North American Jewish millennial in that, in my opinion, the conversation that that Maron and Rogen had is one that I've personally heard a million times among Jews of their generation. You know, we hear it said in private all of the time. They question the Zionism that was fed to them as young people. And Seth Rogen, mind you, you can't accuse him of being some ignorant Hollywood youngster. He went to Jewish school. He was in the Habonim Dror movement. Mm. He had 6 years at a Jewish summer camp for Habonim Dror. He described his Israeli summer camp counselors who were post-army as being psychopaths, so I would really like to hear more details about that. But basically, it's a version of what the If Not Now movement is calling hashtag You Never Told Me, and is saying, you know, he was fed a picture of a flawless, always in the right Israel, and then when he got older and, you know, realized what everyone was up to, he was like, oh, I've been deceived. Israel really has all these faults, has all these flaws, is an occupier, is a terrible thing. And he kind of uses it as a tip of a spear for his disillusionment, I think, with Judaism overall. He said recently, you know, he's realized there's a few good things in Judaism, like the rules of how to sit Shiva, but both he and Maron were sort of, you know, flaunting their connection to the Jewish religion itself, while it's very interesting, they spoke very strongly about anti-Semitism, how they say, you know, Jew haters have always existed and you can't deny the fact that people are anti-Semites. But they say, why would you want to put all the Jews in one basket then, where everyone can round them up and kill them? It's better to have Jews spread out all over the world, you know, where you can't get them in one spot, which is, you know, very interesting, because if they believe that there were these, you know, anti-Semitism is inescapable, then essentially, you know, they believe in the problem, but they don't believe in what was sold to them as a solution, which is having a Jewish state that can protect itself.
Mm. He basically said that Israel makes no sense to him. That was the headline quote that came out of all
right.
of this. You know, I've lived here 30 years, and it makes less and less sense to me every day.
Exactly.
But I think the two of us are in a pretty good position to discuss what he's saying. You know, we moved to Israel from English-speaking communities. We're both products of our respective Jewish communities and youth groups.
Right.
Do you feel like you were lied to, Alison?
I think that maybe I suspected that I was lied to at quite a young age, kind of out of the blue, because I really did not have a classic sort of Zionist education. I had a very mainstream Reform Jewish education that spoke about Israel and spoke about Israel admirably, et cetera. Mm. By the time I got to college and I started to question everything that I'd been told about Israel in a kind of a mild way, or starting to ask questions, before I really could become feeling fully betrayed, I picked myself up junior year for no reason, and I decided to study in Israel and come to Israel, not in a, you know, flag-waving, oh, I'm doing junior year in Israel because I'm a Zionist way, but because let's figure this thing out. Like, let's see what's really going on there. So I think that at a relatively young stage, if you're confronted with the reality of Israel, like if you actually come live here and stay here, that's blunted less, because you have less of a time to sort of create this sort of image or to buy this kind of a Disneyland image of Israel that maybe you're being sold.
Mm. Is that a stage that maybe Rogan missed out on? Has he been here? Do we know?
I mean, he says he's been here, and I presume if he, you know, grew up in Habanim Dror, that he was here probably on kibbutz, right? Mm. His parents met on kibbutz, so, you know, I don't know if he's been on a non-curated trip here. But it seems that he probably has not had a lot of unfiltered experience, you know, in Israel. Also, I find, especially in Los Angeles, people's exposure to Israelis are exposure to the kind of Israelis who move to L.A., which tend to be, you know, not your classic mainstream Israelis. No offense to my friends who are Israelis who move to Los Angeles, but they're also a certain type, you know, the don't mess with the Zohan, et cetera.
Mm.
So one of the reasons I thought it was an unusually deep Jewish conversation was they were talking about the difference between tough, sinewy Jews and wimpy Jews, and they were talking about kind of how Israelis were the tough guys and diaspora Jews are the soft suburban wimps. And they're like, yay, team wimps, you know, go wimps, go diaspora. And what was interesting was when Maron, who's a little bit older than Rogan, he's a couple decades older than Rogan and a bit more thoughtful, he's like, okay, well, if we don't do the Jewish religion and we don't care about Israel and our thing is basically about where you can get a good pastrami sandwiches and all these delis are closing and delis is dying, there's a subtext there of, so where does this Jewish thing go then, you know, with no Israel and no religion, where does it end? And that just reminded me of another controversial cultural Jew, Michael Chabon, who upset everybody by saying, like, okay, he took the next logical step. Is it such a bad thing if all this Jewish stuff ends? And that's where you go if you walk away from the religion and you walk away from Israel. So I thought it, you know, it gets a lot of people thinking. So, but he's definitely, you know, not the voice of his American Jewish generation, but what he said was, a lot of it was almost word for word what you're hearing coming out of these groups like J Street U and If Not Now. And it's, I think, less of a sense of betrayal by Israel itself, but a sense of betrayal against their parents. There was a great article in the Forward saying how this was all Oedipal rage sort of channeled at Israel, angry at the American Jewish establishment, angry at their parents, etc., for, you know, they feel selling them a bill of goods.
Mm. But is it not true that groups like If Not Now are more engaged than Rogan appears to be from this podcast that he was on? You know, it feels like his views are another example of disengagement from Israel. He's not commenting on, you know, the one state, two state solution. He appears to have dismissed the very idea of Israel itself, which strikes me as a little immature.
Yeah, well, but that's kind of his persona, right? I mean, I don't know Seth Rogen. You know, it appears to me there's this disconnect, right, between the image that everyone loves in his movies of sort of like this, you know, out of it stoner type guy, and the fact that, you know, he doesn't just appear in these movies. He produces them. Mm-hmm. He writes them. He's obviously very successful, you know, sophisticated businessman on a certain level. So we kind of don't realize, or, you know, don't know how completely clueless he was. And he and Maron were sort of, you know, building on each other about, you know, how sort of checked out, almost a contest, right, on who was more checked out of the Israel thing and who believed less in the in Israel and in Zionism, etc. But I would definitely like to explore this further with Mr. Rogan, if that's possible.
I understand that that is a possibility that is being discussed.
Well, we'll cross our fingers, right?
Indeed, indeed. So, listen, in your piece, you described the conversation as the deepest dive into Jewish identity in modern celebrity culture in recent memory. So you're not counting Peter Beinart in the celebrity culture category?
Yeah, he's like not exactly a Hollywood guy, Mr. Beinhart isn't. I mean,
not
he's
yet.
Definitely all over the screens, that's for sure. He's on CNN, he's on television, but it's not exactly the same.
Mm. But there is a common theme between Rogan and Beinhart,
right? Oh, absolutely.
Right? The idea, that terrifying idea for some people, that North American Jews are becoming less supportive of the Jewish state and less engaged with Israel.
Right. Well, you know, Beinart really made his, I mean, people knew who he was before, and he was a successful journalist and pundit before, but he made his big splash in 2010, which was kind of the opening shot of this whole, if not now, direction, when he was kind of chastising the American Jewish world for alienating its youth by standing by what he said was a little bit prophetically, right, was an increasingly authoritarian Israeli government, which was moving away from the two-state solution. And he said, you know, it was a warning that if the institutions kept supporting the Netanyahu government the way they did, they were going to alienate further and further the younger generation of American Jews, with which their goal of continuity was kind of shooting themselves in the foot.
And does Seth Rogen belong to this new generation? He's 43, right?
Something like that. Yeah, no, I definitely think that he's almost a poster boy and an illustration. And there's obviously been some sort of evolution on his part. In 2014, he signed a petition from the Creative Community for Peace, which is sort of a liberal but pro-Israel group, kind of criticizing how many attacks Israel was taking over the Gaza war. In 2014, he put himself in the quote-unquote pro-Israel camp. So he's obviously, you know, moved in a certain direction. But this time, you know, Beinhart really took a big step further out of the two-state camp into the one-state camp, and the New York Times headline was really shocking. I no longer believe in a Jewish state, and he still considers a Zionist. He still considers himself a Zionist, but doesn't believe that Zionism has to be realized in a state, and he thinks that there could be a binational Jewish-Palestinian entity, but the Jewish homeland concept could exist within it.
Which is not kind of the level of profundity that Seth Rogen reached.
No, he wasn't I don't think getting into the details that much, you know. I mean, what was unique about Beinart is he's not just pointing at a problem, he's pointing at an alternative solution, and that was a bombshell this time, as well as his writing, his accusations of Jews seeing everything through a Holocaust lens and turning Palestinians into Nazis.
One of the things that Rogan was criticized for, and beyond the what some are calling an overly simplistic response to a very complex issue, is perhaps that today's youth, the people who 20 years ago wouldn't have had the opportunity to educate themselves on what's going on, now do have that opportunity. And perhaps with the internet, the easy access to the almost inevitable exposure to the other side of the argument, perhaps it's no longer a problem that exists.
Right. So the argument used to be that first you have to get the young Jewish kids attached to Israel and familiar with Israel and loving Israel. You have to tell them how great it is and how important it is and how meaningful it is. And then once they establish that attachment, presumably then you can break it to them like, oh, by the way, you know, there have been some problems too. And, you know, what this conversation is saying in this era where kids know a lot at a lot younger age, you have to transform the model of Jewish education in the diaspora to one in which younger and younger kids can understand kind of the flaws and problems that exist in Israel, so they're able to confront them and understand them at a younger age, and that they don't have this big feeling of betrayal.
I mean, speaking personally, you know, I did have a Zionist education growing up, and I was never explicitly taught about the Palestinians. It was very heavy on the ingathering of the exiles part, and right. very light on the specifics. And it was quite a shock, you know, to subsequently learn about Deir Yassin and the Altalena affair. And in those pre-internet days, it really wasn't easy to educate oneself about these things.
Now it's very easy, and there's a lot of people out there who are eager to educate you. And so if you're not getting it from, you know, your own education, your own Jewish education, mm-hmm. your own educational
or
community,
your own
then you're
going to
get educated
curiosity.
By people with different motives.
Absolutely. Alison, let's move on, because in this nonsensical country that we both call home, there is a lot going on. Last night, massive demonstrations against Prime Minister Netanyahu, against his alleged corruption, his government's alleged handling of the coronavirus crisis, and many other issues. So I saw from a photo that you posted from the demonstration near your home. Were you there in a professional capacity, Alison?
Well, no, I was kind of there in a walking block away from my house capacity. I've never had breaking news come so close to my home. I've always had to, you know, go into Rabin Square to see a demonstration, or, you know, go to Jerusalem to see a demonstration. And that's why, you know, this movement has a kind of a crazy momentum, and it feels different than previous waves. You know, the only time last time we saw this kind of national mobilization was on the right, when they were protesting against the Gaza evacuation. Mm. I drove from Netanya to my house in Renana, which is about a 25-minute drive, at about the right time, 6:30, 7:30 on a Saturday evening, which is kind of the weekly now tradition for this. And on overpass after overpass after overpass on the highway, you were just crowded with people with signs saying, you know, the government is cut off from the people, and Bibi is a criminal, and this government has to do something. And it just this stew of discontentment with what's happening.
Mm. And it seems to be infectious. More and more people are getting bitten. People.
I don't think we should be using the word infectious too freely these days, Simon.
Good point. Thank you. I stand corrected. I can't think of a synonym off the top of my head, but can I say that the protests are spreading, or is that also verboten at this time?
No, I'll give you spreading.
Okay,
you
all right, all right. For example, outside the home of our justice minister.
Right, Amir Ohana,
right.
Who had a tape leak where he was sort of berating Jerusalem officials and the police officials that they were not doing enough to stop the growing demonstrations in front of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's house. And the police were saying, but we're handing out tickets for people who aren't wearing masks, you know, and it was clear that Ohana was impatient with that, and he wanted them to do more, and having trouble, obviously, you know, trying to do his job, which he's always been kind of Netanyahu's attack dog, first in the justice ministry and now in the police ministry. Mm. He's been leapfrogged over, you know, rows of other Likud lawmakers, because he's seen as, you know, someone who will do anything for Netanyahu and do anything to help him. But he seems kind of helpless in this situation, because the police are saying, sorry, we're going to listen to the courts, and we're going to listen to our own legal advisors when it comes to what demonstrations we allow and don't allow. And Ohana is left pretty helpless. So you hear him sort of berating the Jerusalem officials in this tape. And when this tape was leaked to the media, people got very angry and started demonstrating outside Ohana's house in Tel Aviv. And I guess also cynically, I have to say, you know, it's good for the people who don't want to make the trip all the way to Jerusalem to do it in front of Netanyahu's house. Ohana is more conveniently located for a lot of the left-leaning population.
Mm. There was also a backlash against what people saw as heavy-handed police response.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, but you can see that as there's been more, you know, outcry against police brutality, that the police are now treading very, very carefully. You see there's less and less of complaints about this, and it looks like they're trying to do their best. First of all, they're all over television, the police spokespeople, you know, trying to explain themselves, and I think they are also not using as harsh tactics. And when they do use harsher tactics, it's all happening at, you know, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. when nobody is broadcasting anymore, and nobody can see them.
But and when, in fairness, the protest has become unlawful after a certain hour of the night, I believe it becomes an unlawful protest.
Yeah, right. So technically, they're only supposed to last until 11 p.m., and then the neighbors are supposed to be able to sleep peacefully, and they're supposed to go away. And in the beginning, they tried to start breaking them up at 11 p.m., and then it got later at 12, and then it got later at 1. So it keeps moving later and later, because the truth is, when you've got, you know, thousands of people, not hundreds of people, thousands of people there, there's no way you're going to be able to disperse it, you know, without using some extreme measures, which they know how bad that's going to look, and they're afraid of making, you know, it's a chicken and an egg, right? The harsher you are with breaking up the protests, the more people get angry, and the bigger they become.
Until we reach the stage when we have things like the wall of moms, right?
Yes, yes, we've got our wall of moms, which was sort of inspired by the movement in the United States in the Black Lives Matter demonstration. Although there was a group that actually preceded this in Israel called Mothers Against Violence. And I'm on their WhatsApp group, and there's all these messages: a mom for every policeman, like, you know, in basketball where you've got there, or in soccer where somebody's, you know, spotting every player, offense and defense. They want a mom on every police officer to make sure that they're behaving themselves. So maybe that has to do with the fact that we've seen less brutality at these demonstrations. The moms are on it,
and not just the moms. I mean, our colleague Lee Yaron reported this morning on what I'm going to call the feminization of these protests, for want of a better word. She wrote that the power behind the protest is female, not just the many female protesters or the exposed breasts. She said that the values of the protest are decidedly female this time. Is that your experience as well, Alison?
Yeah, well, I haven't been to too many of the protests myself in Jerusalem. I won't watch them on television, but I did note, because the coronavirus, statistically, if you've been following the coverage, has been really hurting women much more than the other gender, in terms of, you know, having kids home from school, in terms of who's getting laid off, in terms of who's losing more income. And yet there has not been too much sort of attention as women in the media, in the news, by the politicians. Women are being kept off of all of these, you know, big high councils of deciding policy and what to do. And when did women get attention? Number one, when domestic violence was rising, because everyone was quarantined, and, oh no, women are getting killed, so, you know, when women die, they get attention. And then the next time any women got specific attention as women was when a protester, one of the social workers in the social workers' protest, climbed on the menorah in front of the Knesset topless. And so, you know, apparently that's the female power, is the power to shock and outrage by showing parts of one's body. And then so the next night there was a whole row of female protesters taking off their shirts. And so, yeah, Lee Yaron was talking about how there's this usage of the ability of women to outrage or challenge with overt femininity and sexuality to try to draw some attention in these protests.
And asking why it's okay to try and sell cars using female breasts, and protesting is not okay.
Right, a lot of these women are like, okay, you know, if it's going to be harnessed by the capitalist economy to sell products, then we have every right to harness it, you know, for a cause that we believe in, for something righteous and for justice.
Reclaiming the breast.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure you support it, Simon.
Absolutely. the protests are spreading overseas as well, right? Last night in San Francisco?
In San Francisco, there was, you know, there are so many expat Israelis living in Silicon Valley in the high-tech industry. San Francisco is a big enclave of Israelis overseas who are, you know, a lot of them are very still connected to Israel. They're not overseas because they're rejecting Israel, but just because of career opportunities. And I think they feel very connected to these protests through their friends and family, and diligently reading Haaretz online, I'm sure. So yeah, they formed a big line in front of the Golden Gate Bridge, and we had that. And then there was a similar group in New York City, where there's also a huge population too. Not in Los Angeles, though. Harkening back to our Rogan and Marin conversation.
I wonder why.
Yeah, not yet. Maybe soon.
Not yet.
On the Hollywood sign, wouldn't that be good?
A topless on the Hollywood sign.
Yeah,
perfect.
Something like
perfect.
That. No one would blink twice in Hollywood.
You're absolutely right. Alison, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you, as always, for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it was wonderful. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you, too, to producer Aaron, and, of course, to you, listener. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.